they commissioned my employer, London Business School, to do a study on the link between diversity and financial performance. They did 90 different tests. Not a single one was significant. Firstly, if you think about sustainability of what? Often people think sustainable returns. And they assume what is good for the planet is always good for shareholders. That is not the case. You could be sustainable if your goal is just long-term financial returns. And it could well be that your calculus is that the best way to improve my long-term financial returns is to invest in fossil fuels. Why?
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show where we plug into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI. Today, the topic is sustainable investments and the headwinds that the industry is actually facing. From those being political and geopolitical, think about the challenges that the current MAGA movement is bringing to the ESG backlash in the US, to regulatory, think about the complicated regulations coming into the industry and their constant changing and backtracking. Think about the omnibus in the EU, but also financial, with increasing questions on the performance of sustainable funds and outflows now occurring in a number of different markets. So clearly there is a sense that industry that was seen as something that could deliver purpose and profit at the same time is now being questioned on both. So the goal is really in the show today is to look at the why this is happening and the what can be done about it for us as an industry to move forward. And therefore take it not as a loss, but actually as a period through which we can learn something and get stronger in the industry. And from that perspective, it's exciting that we can bring on board to the conversation today someone that brings a really strong combination of both the academic rigor and evidence world, as well as a practitioner perspective. And that is why I'm honored to welcome Alex Edmonds to the show.
Thanks so much for the invitation, Lorenzo. It's great to be here.
And look, what we wanted to kick off, Alex, was a bit of a human touch. I know that having heard a little bit about your background, you've really started from a Montessori background, which I'm a big fan about, and gone on and did a lot of different things. But what I was curious is to understand what brought you close to sustainable finance. Where does that interest and maybe passion come from, and how did it connect to you?
So I never set out to be a professor of sustainability. I wanted to study finance, what drives long-term value creation within organizations. And before I started my PhD at MIT, I had worked, as you said, for a couple of years at Morgan Stanley in London. And there I saw the importance of corporate culture, in particular, in a setting in which you think it might not matter because the extrinsic rewards were so high. So you earn a lot as a 21-year-old, you get bonuses, you get promoted to associate and vice president. So if people were acting strictly rationally, it didn't really matter how you're being treated, just work hard to get your bonus and to get promoted. But that's not the case in the real world. It really mattered how you were treated. Let's say you don't go to a meeting, which is the case for most young analysts, your boss spends 5 minutes on the way back to call you from her cab and says, oh, you know, this meeting went really well. The analysis that you spent the whole weekend doing, it came up. The client were really impressed by how much you understood the issue. That made a huge difference. And so when I went to MIT and my colleagues being MIT were looking at hard data, quantitative stuff, I wanted to look at the qualitative side. I wanted to look at the link between corporate culture, employee satisfaction, and long-term firm performance. And I found a strong link over 28 years. And that I didn't see as a sustainability factor. I just saw this as a value relevant factor, but it drove me towards the sustainability movement in general, because this highlighted the importance of stakeholder relationships in tangible value as a source of financial value.
Yep, and so the intangible value is probably something that we've seen. I was in reading your book, I saw you were talking about how different the intangible value has changed in terms of weighting over the years. I think there was a stat of something 1970. In the 1970s, it was something around a 20%, and now it's significantly more on the stock market. Look, when we look at sustainability and what's happened now, I'm kind of curious to therefore start looking at the whys. I don't know if you recognize any of the sort of challenges I mentioned at the beginning, but it seems that sustainable investing is not facing the sparkly kind of fantasy world that it faced maybe in the 2019s to the early 2020s. So what do you see are the causes? And maybe going beyond just what are the causes, are some of these causes more endogenous? In other words, as an industry, do we take a responsibility of some of these challenges, or it's all, oh, it's happening and now we need to react sort of question?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really appreciate how you phrase this. So often people think about a sustainability backlash. And I really don't like the term backlash because that has the connotations of an emotional backlash. It is something based on climate denial or being racist and sexist and not caring about DEI issues. Rather than backlash, I'd like to use the terms challenge or pushback because we should always want to challenge our assumptions. It's through challenge that we learn how to do things better. And I do think some of the challenges are actually well-grounded and are endogenous. They are as a result of how some sustainability practitioners have tried to promote the field. So one of them is just the looking at the evidence of the link between sustainability and long-term firm performance. It is certainly true that some sustainability factors like employee satisfaction are correlated with long-term returns, but others are not. And the idea that all sustainability pays off, that just demographic diversity magically improves long-term performance, if you are to look at the data with even a small level of scrutiny, you find that the correlations are very weak, non-existent, they're certainly not causation. And I think the stronger that you push a narrative based on misleading data, the more likely it is that people will push back. So as an example, UK regulator, the Financial Reporting Council, which I respect greatly, they commissioned my employer, London Business School, to do a study on the link between diversity and financial performance. They did 90 different tests. Not a single one was significant. Yet in the executive summary, they claimed significance. So that is really bad practice to claim a result that is not there. And I'm not even talking about whether the methodology was correct. Even if you take the methodology at face value, they found nothing. And so why might this lead to a pushback? If people think, well, this is the quality of sustainability research, then all sustainability research is bogus. And that pushback is obviously too strong, because there is some research which is published in the top peer review journals. But I think if you have just a couple of papers which have been overly pushed, that casts into question everything, just like if a police officer fabricated evidence in one particular trial, then all his or her convictions might be called under scrutiny.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, one of the things that I've been reading up recently, and I don't know how much you're involved in what's your view, is that there's a debate, there's an actually academic debate between some of the research that often was being referenced, which was the research around by Serafin and Bob Eccles around, you know, how, you know, sustainability factors helped outperform. That actually is being questioned by an academic like Andrew King that now is saying that might not be the case. Is there, well, what's your view of that debate? And also, what is the lessons learned? You know, at what point in that, you know, in your book, you're talking about the ladder of misinference, which I found very interesting. What can we learn from us in terms of looking at that, and what should we do next time around to avoid to get trapped into that potential failings?
I think it's first to be aware of confirmation bias. So what is confirmation bias? The idea that we have a view of the world, and if we see something that confirms that viewpoint, we lap it up uncritically, we might put lots of faith in it without even looking at the quality of the analysis. It could be that we're a diversity advocate, as I should be as an ethnic minority, I look at the executive summary. Oh, there's a clear link between diversity and performance. I'm not going to bother looking at the actual tables and the appendix. I'm going to tweet this from the rooftops. So I think when there is something where there is a particular desired outcome, you need to be particularly careful because you might be falling for it because of its appeal, not its accuracy. And indeed, it may well be the producers of that result were trying to skew things in order to give something appealing. So the more tempting something is, I think the phrase too good to be true is not misleading. We do want to be scrutinizing something which does seem to be too good to be true, just like a good deal may well be a scam. That could be the case for some evidence which suggests, oh, just add more diversity and your performance is going to be five times higher than your peers. It also highlights the importance of not putting too much weight on one particular study. So we often bandy around the phrases such as research shows that, studies find that, and then people will pick out one study and cite that study. And even if the study has been published in a peer-reviewed journal, editors and reviewers do make mistakes. And it may well be that science evolves, that they find out those mistakes. And sometimes those mistakes could be honest mistakes. It could well be that a new, better methodology comes around, or there's certain issues with the data that you might not have known because you used the world's the most established data set. But what this means is that we can't just base our entire case of sustainability on one paper. We would like to look at the body of evidence. And my reading of the body of the evidence is that there is certainly a case for taking sustainability seriously. There are papers showing that certain sustainability issues do lead to long-term returns, but it's certainly not that everything which is called ESG is going to be improving returns. Some might be neutral, some unfortunately might be negative. And so we would like to approach this with a clear mind rather than with a particular viewpoint that we want to ensure gets implemented.
This is interesting, and it seems to be going towards how certain performance goals, right, have or have not been achieved based on research. And but to me, part of the crisis today potentially is almost a step back in the sense, is there something about the word sustainable investment, the terminology being used, where people have thought, oh, I'm going to have a fund with no BP in it, and they find that they have BP in it, or the other way around. I have a fund that I would like to be engaging with BP, but it's not in my fund because they believe it shouldn't be in there based on the terminology of the fund. So a lot of the regulators today are trying to address this. Take, for example, ESMA naming rule, right? They're trying to say, we're going to define how things are called. But is that going to solve the problem? Or is there something before on the naming of sustainable investing more generally that needs to be solved to help us cut through this?
So I think the term sustainable investing is a pretty tricky term and misleading term to begin with, because all sustainable means is long term. It has nothing to do with the environment or wider society. You could be sustainable if your goal is just long term financial returns. And it could well be that your calculus is that the best way to improve my long term financial returns is to invest in fossil fuels. Why? Well, number one, we could think that there's a lot of demand for energy. Number two, we think that there's not political willpower for climate action. I've learned about climate change 30 years ago when I was at school, and there hasn't been the action that we would have liked. And number three, we might also think that if other funds are dumping fossil fuels because of some moral ethical stance, then they're underpriced and we could buy them. So firstly, if you think about sustainability of what? Often people think sustainable returns, and they assume what is good for the planet is always good for shareholders. That is not the case. The heart of the ESG issue is externalities. There's certain things that companies can do to affect wider society, and sadly, they can get away with it. So I think the whole idea of saying, well, there's normal investing and there's sustainable investing, No, you could be a traditional investor where your goal is to maximize long-term returns, and then there's no specific lens which has your impact on the environment. It's instead just looking at how things impact returns. So to me, I like the phrase responsible investing. And you might think, okay, is this a small semantic shift? But I think it's more than just semantics, because responsible investing suggests that you are taking account your impact on wider society. So yes, I'm investing, but to invest responsibly is to understand that my actions might have wider effects, just like people say, we'll always drink responsibly, and that could be because of the effects of drunken behavior on those around you. So I think when you have responsibility, then that highlights some externalities. Then how does this get into the greenwashing issue? Do we solve this issue by just calling something responsible? Sadly not, because if you're to take oil and gas, it is actually not clear that if you were to invest in oil and gas, it is definitely irresponsible. Why? One could argue that you could invest in oil and gas and try to engage with the company in order to try to ensure that it is going to develop clean energy sources. Number two, one might argue that right now we do not have enough renewable energy to power the world. So as a transition, we do need some fossil fuels for the time being. Number three, you might think, well, there's other issues. There's people who rely on this industry for jobs. They might be 55-year-old workers in the oil and gas industry who can't easily retrain. And so I think the problem with regulators deciding what is good and what is bad, what is green or not, that's problematic. Why? Who should be the supreme being to decide, okay, this is green and this is brown? Often what might be green or brown changes with the time. Defense used to be brown, and then suddenly Russia invaded Ukraine and now defense is seen to be good. That is something that I think market participants should decide. What regulation should do is force people to be transparent about their investment approach, any constraints, their holdings. But then I think it is for the market to decide whether something is sustainable or not, rather than regulators having one specific view of sustainability or responsibility.
Thanks. This reminds me, and I actually pinned a specific sentence of your book that I wanted to read out, because I wanted to cover the net zero targets and a little bit of, you know, these many initiatives had set up to try to drive net zero. And as you know, both the Net Zero Banking Alliance and the Net Zero Asset Management Alliance, a number of players have left, especially in the U.S., but not only. And in what you wrote was, at a certain point, the problem arises when you view hitting the target as all or nothing. If your training time suggests that 4 hours, this is 4 hours for a training run, is out of reach, you might throw in the towel and opt for a Netflix and ice cream marathon instead, which I thought was a good way to frame this. But, you know, what this seems to point to one of your biased concerns, which is seeing things black and white, right? What is your view today on the net zero initiatives? And, you know, what did something go wrong? And if something did go wrong, what can we do now? You know, what is the right approach? Transition, as you say, oil and gas, there was, you know, we don't have the amount of energy that can be entirely on renewables today. So what is the way forward?
Yeah, so what that section of the book that you kindly quoted is about is the danger of black and white thinking, seeing things in binary terms. And we see this a lot in terms of climate, well, such as 1.5 or bust, which is we need to do everything that we can to hit this 1.5 number, even if it means decommissioning oil and coal and reducing energy security. Why 1.5? Why does it have to be this round number? If indeed there was a tipping point, which if exceeded, it would cause all hell to break loose. There's no reason why it'd be 1.5 versus 1.629. And indeed, what the evidence seems to suggest is there's not so much a bright line. It's sort of every tenth of a degree matters, rather than we are having to go all out to hit one particular number. And similarly, I think this is an issue with net zero. What is so interesting about the number zero? So should it be that companies should all be net zero? Not necessarily. It may well be that you should reduce your emissions by 90%, and that you can do, and maybe that will eat a little bit into your returns, but we think that's fine, because our goal is not just to make money, it's going to have environmental impact. But to reduce that final 10% of emissions could be really, really difficult. So like for a person to be net zero, it may well be that you're cutting a lot of flying, but there's still some flying that you might think you need to do if you've got a sick relative to visit. You could choose to have all of your holidays domestically, but there might still be some flying that you need to do. So I think to go all the way to zero, it's not clear. And indeed, if it suggests that you should go to zero, that suggests that climate will be dominating all other ESG issues. That could be dominating other environmental issues, when there might be trade-offs. For example, we might want to use bioethanol because that is better in terms of net zero as an energy source, but bioethanol, that can lead to monocultures, which is going to be reducing biodiversity. And also the trade-off with other issues. Right now, we have 600 million people in Africa with no access to electricity. If we went all the way to zero, would that be denying people the economic development that we in the West have had? It's very easy for us to say, oh, let's go to zero, not realizing that there's 600 million people in a continent with no access to electricity.
Yeah, that's those trade-offs, I think, in Grow the Pie, you really talk about trade-offs, right? So in a certain sense, when I read the title of the book, I was thinking around, you know, one of the risks or one of the possible reasons why we got to where we got to is over-promising, right? And the title, Grow the Pie, could almost be seen that way at first. It's like, oh, you know, we can get profit and purpose. Hooray, we're done, right? But I think then you need to go read the details of where you're going, which is you bring up these trade-offs, which I think are important. My sense is we need to get into how do we take this next, right? So in the world we're in today, I don't see nuance as something easily put forth. If you think of what's just going on in geopolitics, what seems to win is this black and white thinking. You know, it's not that nuance piece. So how do we positively take the messages that I think you're trying to carry forward and convert them into practical wins, if you see what I'm saying? Because I get really excited of reading this, but then I say, okay, so how do we do this?
That's a great question. I would see the glass as half full rather than half empty. So you talked about endogenous actions. And I think whether people are willing to accept nuanced views is endogenous. So if we have the view, okay, people like to think very simply, and if we don't have a simplistic message, it's not going to cut through. That may well be true for some audiences, but I have been pleasantly surprised that often the silent majority, maybe those who are less active on Twitter and other platforms, are actually willing to hear something which is a bit more nuanced. And it may well be that you lead with the more appealing message, not to be misleading, but because in many cases you can have win-win. So this is why I highlighted the book was the Grow the Pie idea in the book, is that in many cases there are win-wins. There are fewer trade-offs between shareholders and society if we take a long-term perspective. For example, investing in your workers is costly in the short term, but in the long term, the workers are more motivated, more productive, and more likely to stay. The pie grows, profits become higher. And so if I start with that message, it is a message which is backed up by data. I'm not using it as a Trojan horse. And then people think, oh, I am somebody on their side. I am somebody who understands the value of sustainability or responsibility. And then when I highlight, well, actually, it is not the case that every single thing fits this example. There are still trade-offs. People might think, okay, well, that is interesting. He's not somebody pushing back on everything in responsibility. He recognizes there are win-wins, but I also accept that it would be too naive to think that everything is a win-win. So it's these trade-offs where we need to decide which way to go. And even if there's a trade-off, it still is completely legitimate to pursue the responsible option and accept the return sacrifice, but then it's just to be upfront about that. So if you're a company, rather than saying, oh, what's good for business is good for society, you might say, no, this is something where I am going to decarbonize faster than I need to, because I think you shareholders This might be something that you have as an objective, not just financial returns, and that is legitimate if they've had that conversation with their shareholders. And indeed, for mutual funds, if you're a mutual fund whose goal is not going to be just financial returns, but societal impact, make that clear in your prospectus.
Maybe can we drive into some of these trade-offs on the specific area that I think you're focused on, which is human capital and DEI. One of the, I think, big, there was a decent number in a long period of time where DEI was framed as, look, you need to have DEI on your board and your staff, because if you do that, you'll get better returns. And I think you've argued that that's not always the case. In what way do you see it being the case? And how do we, what's the conversation we can now have on investors? Because, you know, people are pulling out and even stopping some of their programs. How do we make sure that the next step is not all or nothing, right? So what can be done instead that is constructive on the DEI side?
So I think the core heart of DEI is absolutely value creating and absolutely positive, which is we have our biases, and our biases can lead to discrimination where we are hiring the wrong people because they might not look like us, or they might not look like our view of what a successful leader should be. So if your view is that as an investment banker, a successful person is white, male, aggressive, tall, well-spoken, then it could well be that women are discriminated against, that ethnic minorities are discriminated against, and also maybe more introverted people are discriminated against. And if we are to ignore those irrelevant factors when hiring, hire purely based on merit, then we will have the best possible outcomes. And I know people don't like the term meritocracy, but when I talk about merit, by this, I don't just mean the best test scores or going to the best universities. What I mean by merit is your potential going forward. So when you hire somebody, you don't care about what they did in the past. You care about, will they be successful for your company going forward? And it may well be legitimate to hire somebody who's below another candidate if their trajectory is faster, because you think they're going to continue to develop. And for that, you may well take background characteristics into account. If indeed certain ethnic minorities might have been disadvantaged, that's something you might take into account. Also, if somebody with from the UK with a different accent in the north, they might also have be discriminated against. That is something which will be relevant. But we're all taking this into account with the view of hiring the best people, where the best people is in terms of number one, potential, and number two, your fit with the team. However, sometimes there has been mission creep where DEI has gone a bit too far, where the goal is not necessarily to hire the best people, but to say we need a quota of X percent of the board needs to be ethnic minorities or X percent needs to be female. Now, this seems to be sensible, and that you might think, oh, well, diverse teams make better decisions. We're going to have differences of thought. But it's actually far more complicated than that. Yes, I absolutely agree that we want different viewpoints. But to say, well, your gender and ethnicity is the only determinant, or even the primary determinant of whether you have a different viewpoint, is extremely reductive. You're reducing the complexity of a person to just their gender and ethnicity. You give the impression that if you're a white male, you can never add to the diversity of an organization, even if your background is humanities and everybody else is in finance. Now, the idea that we can be very reductive has been supported by studies by the likes of the FRC or McKinsey or BlackRock, claiming that gender or ethnic diversity pays off. But as I mentioned, those studies are extremely weak, and this should not be surprising that when you reduce the totality of a person to just two characteristics, you really don't get much as a byproduct. So, what does this mean in terms of DEI? We should absolutely pursue the spirit of DEI, which is to get the best people, to ensure that we are not being discriminatory when hiring, and also get a mix of different opinions. But that involves looking at more than just the gender and ethnicity, having some quotas, which can sometimes lead to discrimination against white men. So I know sometimes there have been positions where people have said, oh, only if you're a minority should you apply. I've been approached to apply for positions because I was told they needed more non-white faces, which is insulting to me. and also insulting to the white men who might have been better than me for that position. So to ensure that we are going truly for meritocracy, and also we're trying to take a diversity of backgrounds into account, which could come from just more, far more than your gender and ethnicity.
This kind of diversity, which is not demographic, seems to be more cognitive diversity in a way that I think is what your positioning, I think, is quite critical. And I've seen it even in my own professional work at places where different backgrounds have been very helpful in the kind of outcomes that we've been able to deliver. Look, one of the things that is interesting in reading the work you've done is trying to go up and try to understand where our biases are, and seeing that in a way it's not data alone that solves those dilemmas, that you actually need to keep going into what you call the ladder of misinference. So in sustainable investments, I think there's a lot of desires and need to kind of aggregate a lot more data than you might necessarily typically look on sustainable on traditional finance. And that is just because there's a lot more factors that you might want to take into consideration. And, you know, I'm thinking of your own experience in Morgan Stanley, probably just the numbers would have just answered all the questions of why your experience there was particularly strong. So if trying to sit within a chair of a sustainable investment portfolio manager and analyst, how do you actually look at the lessons that your work has done to actually really find the real signals that sustainable aspects do have a contribution to outperformance or to risk management?
This is to look at the difficult signals that are difficult to understand, which are fluffy and dirty and nuanced and grey. And you might think, well, that's a lot of work. Isn't just easier to look at demographic diversity as a proxy for cognitive diversity, or to go with some ESG rating? Well, if it was really that simple, then it would already be priced in the market. So in order to be a successful investor, we need to be contrarian. We need to find things which other investors might not be willing to understand. And in the field of sustainability, that is increasingly difficult because there are now more other investors out there looking at regular data sources. So I don't think we can just look at carbon emissions or MSCI ESG ratings and hope to get alpha. We do need to look at something more complex. And for that same reason, I think sustainable investing should be mainstream, which is again why I don't like the term sustainability, because it suggests it should be niche. Indeed, I wrote a paper called The End of ESG a couple of years ago, where I'm saying basically all investing should be ESG investing, because if you are an investor, you should want to take into account any financially material factor which is also not taken account by the rest of the market because it's complex. So to give specific examples, that may well be in the field of diversity. You could be trying to look at cognitive diversity, or not just diversity, but also look at equity and inclusion and psychological safety, because that is key for the potential of diversity to be fully realized, so that the different opinions actually end up being expressed because they feel the environment is inclusive and safe for you to do so. If you think about climate, it may well be not just looking at climate change mitigation, which obviously lots of people are seeing as important, but climate change adaptation. So might this be companies which are developing seeds which are able to grow in more temperate climates? Or might it be other environmental issues beyond climate? Or could it be second and third order climate effects which might not be captured in standard measures? So as an example, I've served on the Royal London Asset Management Responsible Investment Committee for nearly a decade, which has been a huge pleasure and a great learning experience. We put our portfolio through MSCI's tool, which shows the contribution of the stocks in your portfolio towards global warming, and it found that the worst offenders were semiconductor companies. Why? Because when you make semiconductors, it releases perfluorocarbons to the atmosphere, and that's even worse than carbon dioxide for trapping in heat. Yet semiconductors could be the solution to global warming. Why? Because they could be used in solar panels and be really helpful for the energy transition. So often when we think about just the harm that companies do, and often these metrics are on carbon emissions, they don't look at avoided emissions. And I know there is some talk about having this under a scope 4, but this is probably many, many years off. As one final example of this, I've joined about 18 months ago the Sustainability Advisory Council of Novo Nordisk. And Novo Nordisk has these hugely popular weight loss drugs. They've chosen not just to sell them within Western Europe, where they would make most money, but to sell some in developing countries. Not only is there a profit sacrifice, but it's bad for carbon footprint to ship them over. However, if you prevent somebody getting obesity, not only is that good in and of itself as a social outcome, but if somebody ends up not getting type 2 diabetes, they don't need to go to hospital 3 times a week and have dialysis. And those journeys are typically car journeys all the time. And there's a lot of avoided emissions down the line. So can we, as a sustainable investor, look at companies which do have positive societal impact, but it's difficult for other investors to notice because it's qualitative, like cognitive diversity, or because it's a second and third order effect, like the effect on climate change, or because it's on issues which are under the radar, maybe adaptation rather than mitigation, or other environmental issues beyond climate, such as local pollutants and particulate emissions.
You mentioned this, and I love, by the way, these trade-offs that you bring in the nuisance of semiconductors, you know, and the positive and the negatives, and even how, you know, the Novo Nordisk example, it's not just a simple black and white solution, is looking at the different aspects. And because of that, I wanted to ask you your view and experience with AI. I know that you've even, in your book, For May Contains Lie, you even have a sort of a custom GPT where you can put up a paper and your custom GPT tells you how good or bad it is, which, by the way, I've used and I found it extremely humbling and useful. But in your own experience in sustainable and a sustainable investment world, do you think AI can be a helpful tool in trying to address some of the challenges and even the nuances that we're trying to get to?
I think it can certainly be a helpful tool. So it can be very good at aggregating quantitative data. For example, rather than having to gather a sustainability metric by looking at lots of individual company sustainability reports, AI can do that for you very, very quickly and efficiently. But just like my views on virtually everything else, are nuanced and not black and white, it's the same with AI. I think it's a useful tool, but I don't think it can ever replace the value of humans. For example, to be able to speak to management and to get a feel for the company as to whether the leadership takes these issues seriously, how they manage trade-offs, what they view as the purpose of the firm, I think that's difficult. There is one fund I know pretty well called the Evli Emerging Frontier Fund, which was the number one ranked emerging markets fund in Bloomberg. And what they do is they just have a very boots on the ground approach, just going and meeting management and looking at the factories and seeing how workers are being treated. I don't think that's something that AI is able to replace. So it's a useful tool, and it means that the low-hanging fruit will be very easy to pick. But then that means that we do need to focus on the grey, dirty, complex issues that I mentioned earlier, because really the quantitative stuff, that would be table stakes.
Yeah, so it's that element of making sure that there's human in the loop, almost, you know, that language, and that the two of them work together, and that ultimately the gray areas gets assessed by a human, not by a machine. I think that's great. Thank you. Look, I think we're getting close to the end, so I wanted to quickly just send a few quick fire round questions for you. Just really what I'm going to ask is just respond to what comes to your mind, and feel free to answer just a few thoughts or words. The first one is ESG, alpha or beta?
Alpha, but the alpha could be negative and as well as being positive.
Fund labeling or broad ESG integration?
Broad ESG integration every day.
Materiality, single or double?
single, because that's how many fund managers interpret fiduciary duty, unless you have a clear mandate from your clients.
Purpose, competitive advantage, or moral obligation?
I think it's a competitive advantage, because many companies don't have a purpose, or if they do, they don't actually put it into practice.
Asset owner or asset manager, who drives the future of sustainable investments?
I think it will be asset owners, because asset managers are agents of asset owners. So if asset owners call the shots, then asset managers will implement what their preferences are.
Great. And last one, what's more dangerous, greenwashing or greenhushing?
Greenwashing, because I think this is what has led to a lot of the pushback against sustainability. And I think some of this pushback is deserved.
Thanks, Alex. We're getting to a part of the show that I get pretty excited about, which is linked. And I get excited because I like to bring together sustainability and ideas of art or music. And so we ask each guest to bring a piece of art or music that they're particularly keen or care about and to explain why. And then we say if there's any of the previous pieces of art that have been brought, if there's any thoughts or comments from your end. So I wanted to see if you had thought of something that you wanted to share in terms of what you like or have identified and why.
So in terms of art, actually for drawing, I know nothing about. It was by far my worst subject at school. So at my school, you could either choose art or technology or music. So for me, I chose music, which explains my choice. So I'd like to share the song Circle of Life by Elton John. And many people who know that song, yeah, they think, yes, it's got a sustainability theme. They focus on the chorus, the circle of life, the idea that we want to leave the planet in a better place than what we found it. I would, again, want to be a bit contrarian and look at some of the verses, which might not have got as much attention. So in verse one, there's the line, there's more to see than can ever be seen, more to do than can ever be done. And in verse two, there's a line, there's far too much to take in here, more to find than can ever be found. And I think what this highlights is just the beauty of the earth, just the amazing things that we can see and do. Some of them are natural, some of them are artificial, such as art and music and theatre and drama. And I think this often gets lost in sustainability conversations. So there are some views that the purpose of business is to solve problems for people and planet. That's one definition. We like to want to measure things like disability-adjusted life years. But the goal is not just existence or lengthening life. It's not just to solve problems. If your goal was to solve problems, let's scrap the Olympic Games and the World Cup. Let's scrap art history and museums, Chessington World of Adventures, all of those things, because there's a big carbon footprint. There might be accidents from going on theme park rides. What we want to do is flourish. And if we are to flourish and enjoy the beauty of the earth in a way that minimizes our environmental impact, I think that's a positive thing. Also, if I was to take the phrase, there's more to see than can ever be seen, more to do than can ever be done, that might suggest, oh, we need to get on a plane and fly everywhere to see everything in the world. But it's not. It's to try to highlight the beauty in what we might already have. And I'm seeing this a lot with my two young kids, is that this means that most of the holidays we take, they're all within the UK. There's so many beautiful places that you can go within the UK. Even if it's the local park, there might be places within that local park that you haven't gone to. In terms of music, how often have you listened to music? And you might think, well, I listen to music every day. I listen to it on my commute. By listen, I mean listen to music. Not in the backdrop when it's your commute or when you're washing the dishes, but if you were to listen to a piece of music, you might hear some harmonies and melodies that you might have not done otherwise. Why do we need to consume and buy more stuff, buy more music? Have you actually ever truly listened to the music collection that you already have?
Thanks, Alex. That's great. I think that sense of appreciation we probably all need to learn from. I hear a lot from that. It touches me. I don't know if you got a chance to see or listen to the Vivaldi music that we've published in the past. We had a particular, Vivaldi was, I don't know if you've heard, basically there's a piece of music by Vivaldi that's been rewritten by AI to basically capture the impact on the music from a climate perspective. Just checking if you got a chance to hear it and what you thought about that.
I liked it. It sounded different. And I think this is also something which shows just the huge, immense creative possibilities of AI. Now, AI did work with something which was composed by a human, but then to add some variation to that, I think is interesting. And it means that we might not be listening to the same song all the time. It could be our favorite song, but we're adding some variation to that, and that leads to some variety and some depth and some breadth.
Look, I'm extremely actually honored from this conversation and very excited about it. I think we've learned a lot. In the face of these headwinds, I think your optimism and positivity, but really grained into the ground, into realism and nuance, I think is extremely positive and it helps us move forward. I think there's some clear messages around making sure that whatever we claim is founded through solid evidence and that we can grow the pie as long as we are honest about the trade-offs. So I think thanks, Alex, for being on the show. For us, it's been great. Thanks, Curtis, for being in the production and for everyone else behind the scene for making this happen. Alex, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Lorenzo. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Great. And for everyone else, look, I hope you enjoyed the episode. And please make sure you take a look at previous shows, like, subscribe, and comment if you have any interest of any future episodes that you'd like us to tackle. In the meantime, please stay wired.
Copyright 2025, Clarity AI. All rights reserved. Clarity AI does not assess current market trends, legal or regulatory developments, but only opines on recent ESG-relevant developments. The information and data contained herein are proprietary of Clarity AI and or third-party content providers. These are intended for informational, non-commercial use only and may not be copied, distributed, or used in any other way, including via citation. They are not directed to or intended for distribution to or use by India-based clients or users, and their distribution to Indian resident individuals or entities is not permitted. These do not constitute an endorsement of any product, project, investment strategy, or consideration of any particular environmental, social, or governance-related issues as part of any investment strategy. Nor an investment advice or expert opinion are not part of any offering and do not constitute an offer or indication to buy or sell securities and have not been submitted to or received approval from any relevant regulatory bodies. Clarity AI assumes no responsibility for the reliability, completeness, or accuracy of any opinion provided herein. It makes no representation or warranty as to any of the information, including, without limitation, any representation or warranty that the information or any portion of it is accurate, complete, or suitable for a particular purpose. Clarity AI nor its content providers are responsible for any damages or losses arising from use of this information, and use is subject to conditions available at clarity.ai.